My name is Rex Walheim, and I'm the Deputy Director of Safety and Mission Assurance at the Johnson Space Center, and I'm also an astronaut, management astronaut now.
I wanted to get started. You're in town here on the peninsula with a program that NASA does. It's kind of an outreach program. Maybe just to start off, if you could talk a little bit about what that program does and what it brings to local communities like this.
Well, sure. So the astronaut office at the Johnson Space Center, we get a number of requests all over the country, really all over the world, for people who'd like an astronaut to come speak to them. And so there's a number of requests, kind of more than we can fill, but we advertise to the astronauts who are available, and folks look at people they want to speak to, groups they want to meet, or places they want to go, and they can decide if they've got time to volunteer. And so when you're an active astronaut still flying, you do about maybe one a month or one every other month. And they rank them on whether they're considered must-dos or whether they're voluntary. If they're requested by a congressman or a center director of one of the NASA centers, then they can be must-dos. So you do a few of those, but then you do a bunch of voluntary ones too.
And this is one of those voluntary.
Yeah, it was one of those voluntaries, but it's one of the highly sought ones, is to be able to come up to Alaska. So when I saw it, I grabbed it as quick as I could, because the funny thing was, I looked on the website and it said Homer in Anchorage, and it said AR, which would be Arkansas. So I think a lot of the other astronauts saw the Arkansas and said, "Nah, I don't think so." But I go, "That's not Arkansas." So I looked a little deeper. Oh, yeah, that's Alaska. And so I was really excited to say, "I can do that." And it was coming to the close of when they needed to find somebody by. And so I said, "Well, yeah, I'll be glad to do it." And so I jumped at the chance.
Very good. Well, and we're very happy to have you here. So when you're making the rounds, and again with this program that sends astronauts all over, is it what's kind of the drive behind it? What's the point behind it? The mission behind it, for lack of a better term? Is it just to sort of spread the gospel of science? Is that too strong a term?
Well, to a certain extent, it's to teach people about what we're doing for the space program. Basically, you know they're the people who fund the space program, the American taxpayers, and we want to tell them what they're getting in return for that. And so we want to share a little bit about space flight and about the space program. And to be honest, you want to share about the magic of spaceflight. It's a magical thing to get a chance to ride on a rocket and go off this world. It's absolutely amazing. And to be able to share that to people and to hopefully inspire them. And part of the presentations I give, I vary the presentation to who the audience is. And if I'm giving it to school kids, I want to tell them that, hey, when I was a kid, I was dreaming about flying and maybe doing something like this. And so if I can do it, they can achieve their dreams also. And so it's to inspire kids. And then a corollary to that is, if they want to do something in the space program, they're going to need a technical degree. They need to study, science, math, technology, or maybe medicine potentially too, as we select astronauts who are doctors, physicians. So to kind of inspire them in that. Now, another reason we go out in these speaking engagements is we sometimes go to our contractors who develop, parts of the space program or, components of the space program. And we go out there to say thanks to them and to encourage them for their work that they do. So it's important to go out to those suppliers, and some of those suppliers are all over the world. And so we go out to, I went out to Germany once to talk to a supplier of made ball bearings for the space shuttle main engines. Now, funny side story of that, my father was a B-17 pilot in World War II, and obviously we were at war with Germany, and he didn't get overseas, but some of his colleagues were, flying overseas in Germany trying to bomb these same plants out of existence. And here I was, generations later, going there to thank them for their work and encourage them to do good work to keep me safe on the space shuttle.
That speaks volumes to what space exploration and science can do for diplomacy a little bit. And
yeah. Diplomacy is a big part of it. It's not an official part, but especially when you look at United States and Russia, there's not a whole lot of ties holding our countries together right now, but the space program is certainly one of them. We treat each other like brothers and sisters, and we know how to get along. We've been working together for, over 20 years now with the International Space Station, and we help each other, and we are good partners. When we're on board the space station, we're one crew. We eat together, we solve problems together, laugh together. We are full of partners on board there, and we've learned from the ground level all the way up to the astronauts how to get along.
That speaks to what I imagine being a very unique and interesting and relatively small sort of fraternity of astronauts and folks who have shared that experience of flying hundreds of miles above the Earth. And I'm really curious for you individually, what does that do for your perspective the first time you're up there and you can see the entirety of the world? No matter how much training you've done, I have to, and I know that there's so many other things on your mind when you're up there and you're very mission focused, but even just a few seconds to take that in, what does that do for your perspective? And especially then when you come back.
Right. And so it's it does change your perspective for a lot of folks. And for me, I had this kind of impression that the first time I looked at the earth, I'd float up to the window and gaze on the majesty of the earth in this magical moment. But what I didn't know is, and I like I should have known, is that on the first day, a lot of people aren't feeling good. And so there's, you know, there's because we get this space adaptation sickness, which is really just, you know, seasickness kind of. And so some people aren't feeling good and you're rushing around, you're doing all sorts of stuff and you're not feeling good. And you kind of look at the window and go, yeah, that's beautiful. And then you kind of stop and you go back to work because you're racing around trying to get stuff done. But then as the day rolls on and you know, a couple of days later, you're starting to feel really good and you got a couple of free minutes. You sit in front of the window, you poke your nose up against the window and you look out and it is absolutely mesmerizing to see this, you know, continental scale, to see, you know, for 1,000 miles, you can't see the entire globe at low Earth orbit because you can, you know, you're only 250 miles up, mm-hmm. but you can see 1,000 miles in any direction. And you're going Mach 25, you know, 17,500 miles an hour. So the continents are going by. Now that sounds like they'd be blaring by, but they're not because you're so high up. It's a graceful, you know, movement underneath you. And so it's really actually fun to sit out there and watch and to see these places and to go over places that, you know, one of the pictures I like to show is of the Middle East. And I show people what it looks like. And it's really pretty from up in space because it's a lot of very little clouds and stuff. And you can see, you know, the Mediterranean Sea and the Sea of Galilee, the Dead Sea and stuff. And so you look down there and it just looks beautiful. But I show them that when you, yeah, it looks beautiful from here, but when you think about it, that's some of the most war-torn areas of the country, of the world. You know, you've got Egypt, Israel, you've got Iraq and Syria and Jordan, and it's just a tough neighborhood down there. But in the same picture, I'd like to point out on the edge of the earth, there's this little blue band right along the edge of the earth, and it's just this tiny little sliver, and that's our atmosphere. It doesn't go up that high. And that's all that keeps us together. When you look down at there, it shows that there's a lot more that holds us together that we should be cooperating on. Because when you look at it from above, there's no question that all those people down there are passengers in the same spacecraft. And so if you have that kind of eye-opening experience, you can kind of see that. And it gives you that more incentive to cooperate and figure out how you can solve some of these problems.
Were these sorts of things... Were you cognizant of these things? Just cause I know, you know, growing up and being interested in the space program, but you come from an engineering background, which you don't
right.
necessarily always identify with someone who's super in touch to nature and the world,
right.
how that works. And it's a different kind of a mindset and to build those kinds of skills that get you on the space shuttle.
Right.
But then I'm sure that also adds to that perspective that you're able to gain.
You know, it doesn't. Some of the perspective gain that happens when you fly in space doesn't happen exactly when you're flying there because you're so concentrated on your mission.
Right.
There's so much going on. But it's when you come back and you think about it and you look at the pictures that you took and you have a chance to reflect on it that you really see, you know, how it can change your perspective.
And I'm so focused on this because when you look back at the history of the space program, you know, some of the things that we can tie directly to our exploration of near Earth and to the moon, and especially in the 60s during the space race, you know, there's that first very famous picture of a moonrise, and that did so much to, again, change people's perspective and give them a different look at this Earth that we're all on.
Yeah.
And is it now kind of part of the mission to try to extend that beyond just the initial shock of that 50 years ago, that out of that was born, you know, the EPA and so many things were born out of that sort of revelation.
Yeah.
Is it a challenge to continue that when we have, I would say, sort of less attention paid to all the effort that is being put into space exploration?
Yeah, I think it comes natural. And the folks who are, you know, some of the folks who go onto the space station stay there for 6 months to a year, and they're constantly having the chance to take pictures and share them via Twitter, via social media. So there's a real opportunity with social media to share some of those images and videos about, you know, what it's like to look on the Earth from up there. And we get some absolutely amazing images. And I think it's a natural byproduct of the space program.
I wanted to talk about your specific time in the space program because it goes back to it covers most of the shuttle program, almost mm-hmm. 30 years of the shuttle program. You started as and to go back a little bit further than that, it wasn't even a sure lock that you were going to be recruited into the astronaut corps. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, when I graduated from college, I had a good, you know, 10-15 year plan to become an astronaut, I thought. So I was going to go and get an engineering degree at Berkeley, and then I was going to go into the Air Force, and I was going to be a pilot, then I want to be a fighter pilot and a test pilot, and then apply to be an astronaut. They're kind of the standard way, you know, the Mercury days of how they became astronauts.
Sure.
My real goal was to fly airplane. I wanted to be a pilot, and that was an achievable goal, and if I could ever become an astronaut, that was what I wanted to do. And so I got down to Williams Air Force Base where I was going to start pilot training. And one of the first things they do is to give you a physical. And I had them before, but you know, there's never, you never know what's going to happen on a physical. And this time the doctor said he heard a heart murmur. And so he said, this heart murmur is not a health hazard, but you can't be a pilot. So we're gonna not going to let you be a pilot. So I thought my dreams were crushed. And so I figured, well, I'll never be a pilot, I'll never be an astronaut, you know. But they gave me a chance to be an engineer in the Air Force. So I took some various engineering jobs through the Air Force. And along the way, I heard that you could actually be a backseater, an engineer who flies with the test pilots and flight test airplanes. You could get a waiver for your physical and for this heart murmur. And so I thought, well, I was kind of hesitant to jump on that and really pursue that, you know, because I had my dreams crushed by not being a pilot. But I thought, okay, well, I'll get the master's degree and I'll get the experience I need. And if this ever works out, that'd be great because I'd finally get to fly in airplanes, not be the pilot, but be a crew member, you know, a flight test engineer. And so I applied to the school and I got the waiver for my heart murmur and then I didn't get in. And so I had to work another couple years before I could apply again. And when I applied this time, I got in and I went to get my waiver. And I was in Colorado Springs at the time, and I went to the chief cardiologist at the Air Force Academy. And he said, well, you don't need a waiver because you don't have a heart murmur. And so it turns out the criteria had changed in the 6 years or so that since I'd been at pilot training, and their echocardiograms, the sonograms of the heart, they'd gotten much better. And so they said, nope, you don't have one. And so, holy cow. You know, people ask me if I was mad, and I really wasn't mad. You know, I could have potentially gone back to pilot training at that point, but I had worked 6 years to become an engineer and to work my way up, and I had a mm-hmm. ticket to be a flight test engineer now. And I think the good Lord knows I'm better engineer than I am a pilot. And so I would have been an okay pilot, but if I was going to be an astronaut, I'd have to be the best pilot. And
right.
Necessarily wouldn't have been the best pilot, but I'm a good engineer and I could compete with the engineers. And so I went to the Edwards Air Force Base where they train test pilots and test engineers and had a great time. And now I was finally doing what I love to do, flying airplanes. And so test pilot school is one of the hardest courses I've ever done in my life. It's even harder than astronaut training. And but if you love something, you have the passion for it, you can excel at it. And so I did well there. And then I went off to the F-16 squadron there and started doing flight tests on the F-16s and the two-seater models there. So then I had to start dusting off the old dream of being an astronaut again, thinking, well, hey, I've got some of the experience. I worked as a flight controller for a while in Houston before, when I thought my astronaut dreams were dead. So I had a little bit of space experience, and I had the flight test experience, and so now I could apply to be an astronaut. So I decided, I'll apply, but you know, I might want to keep it on the down low a little bit, you know, just so I don't want people asking, you know, too many people asking, hey, did it work out? Did it work
right.
out? But and that works out for a while. You can kind of have a network among the friends who are applying to be astronauts down at Edwards Air Force Base. And so, but then when you get the call that you got an interview down in Houston, the word spreads and it's like, okay, now if I don't get this, everybody's going to know about it. And so I went down to Houston, did all the incredible medical tests they send you through, and came back to Edwards Air Force Base and got the answer that no, I wasn't accepted. So now I'm going, okay, well, fortunately I was doing something I love. You know, people ask me, what the best background to have to be an astronaut? And the answer is, do what you love. Because then because the odds are you're not going to become an astronaut. So if you don't, you want to be doing something you love. So if I never mm-hmm. became an astronaut, I was flying airplanes and doing flight tests and being in the Air Force, and I loved that. So I was disappointed, but I wasn't crushed. So I think 2 years later, though, it's time to do it all over again and, you know, fill out all the applications and go out and then finally get an interview again and then go down there. And I came back to Edwards Air Force Base, and this time they called me and said, do you want to join the 1996 class of astronauts? And I said, I sure do. And so headed down to Houston. So it's a very circuitous path to become an astronaut. And what I like to tell people is, you know, most people don't set out to be an astronaut and say, hey, I think I'll go to pilot training, I'll get eliminated for medical reasons, and I'll get sent to all these various engineering jobs, including being stationed in North Dakota, you know, and then thinking, well, that ought to set me up to be an astronaut. Well, you know, that's not the path I was planning for, but it's the path I took, and I was finding that persistence was more important than the path I took. It was more important to be persistent and to follow the path and make those corrections to the original path as needed, and eventually was able to become an astronaut.
I have to imagine that, especially when you're talking to school-aged kids, that's probably part of the message that you try to drive home the most, is that if you are focused in some sort of area where this would be applicable, figure out what that is. I mean, that's right. Really the key is early on, figure out what you are passionate about and follow that, because you just never know.
Exactly. And to enjoy the trip along the way. And there's a sweet spot of age of kids that'll understand that, you know, the youngest kids, you just show them the smoke and fire of spaceflight and they like that. And that's about all they're going to get out of it. But, you know, you get the middle schoolers and the high schoolers and you can kind of impress on that. And the story I like to tell them is, after I was eliminated from pilot training, they sent me up to North Dakota, and a small, tiny little radar site up there with 35 people or so. We were 15 miles from a town of 1,500 people.
Uh-huh.
And the nearest McDonald's was in another country. So it was a bit of a challenge. But when I got up there, there was a lieutenant up there who just hated being there. And he would never let me not know that he hated being up there. And I thought, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to try to make the best of it. And so, I figured out places I could go hiking. There was even a ski slope there, a very small one. I think it took me 3.5 minutes to go up the chairlift, and my best run I could get down in 38 seconds. But hey, it was fun.
There was a chairlift?
Yeah, there was. Yep, in North Dakota.
Wow.
In the northern North Dakota, there's a small ski hill. It's more of a valley, and so you would ski down the valley and back up, But anyways, so... what I like to tell folks is, some of the key lessons I learned there is, one, you got to do a good job wherever you are. So if I, just moping and saying, hey, I didn't sign up to come to North Dakota, so I'm gonna hate it here. I'm gonna just do the minimum to get by. I never would have become an astronaut because I possibly wouldn't, because I have to do a really good job everywhere I went. And so I treated that job like I really want to excel at it. I want to try to be a good crew member of the people that I work with. And, so some people would think, well, after you finish, 15 months in North Dakota, you probably put that in your rearview mirror and never think about it again. But I remember, and people would think, especially if you finally, got back on the path you want to and became an astronaut, North Dakota, that's behind you. But I remember I was on the flight deck of the Space Shuttle Atlantis, and I'm looking down, and I tell my crew members, hey, we're over North Dakota. And they're looking down and like, yeah, it wasn't particularly spectacular from 250 miles up. I go, no, it's North Dakota. Grab a camera. So I'm trying to take a picture of my old site. And on my first mission, I missed it. Couldn't quite get it. I was like 5 miles off. The second mission, there was a little bit of cloud cover, so it wasn't so good. But this last mission, I'm 135. I was looking through the telephoto lens. And Grant, you're going 17,000 miles an hour at 250 miles up. And this is a tiny little site. But I looked and I started to snap some pictures and I was thinking, that might be it. As I snapped pictures, got back down, dead set in the middle. There's a beautiful picture of my old site. And the lesson is there, even if you accomplish these great dreams and stuff, these little detours you may think of your career, they become a part of you and they're important. And you have to realize that every career is going to have these detours, and you're going to have your own personal North Dakota where you get sent off somewhere you didn't expect to go. So you got to make the best of it. And you might be surprised that later in life, when you reach those dreams you want to, how you look back on that experience. And it might be something that you reflect back on that was a really good deal.
It's difficult to recognize sort of a character building kind of a period in your life until you have the
exactly.
opportunity to look through, with the benefit of hindsight. Then
right.
you can tell
yep.
what made you do this, that, or the other thing,
right.
for sure. And so glad that you mentioned that. As a person from the Midwest, I'm delighted to hear that there's some positive takeaways from
that's right.
from the time
you
that you spent there. That's fantastic. I mentioned it a little bit, but again, in sharing that experience, that's a very unique experience. And I know that, as the different programs throughout NASA's history have gone along, Mercury and Gemini and Apollo and on we go, each one of those different programs has sort of its own kind of a fraternity and a brother and a sisterhood
yeah.
that goes along with it. And being a member of the final shuttle flight in 2011, was
yep.
that right?
July 2011.
Talk a little bit about what that was like to sort of, and again, with your perspective of having worked in the shuttle program for so many years, what was that like to sort of see that kind of come to a close and see that period end and lead into another area,
right.
era, which we'll get into.
So it was interesting. It was an interesting process. Originally, we were only going to have three final flights. It's going to be STS 120, 32, 33, and 34. So those are going to be the final flights. And so I volunteered for those flights because I was getting close to about time where it was my turn to rotate back into a flight. And said, hey, I'd love to fly on it. But they came back, they named all the crews, and I wasn't on one of them. And so I was pretty sad, thinking, no, I'm probably not going to get to fly in space again.
Yeah, because the number's up.
There's only so many flights left. But then
yeah.
they started talking about having an STS-135, an extra flight, because there was an extra tank. And there were extra solid rocket boosters, and the shuttles were still good, so they could potentially fly these, but there wouldn't be a rescue shuttle available. And so they figure out a way, we're going to assign these crew in case we can figure out, we get the funding for it, and we figure out a way to do this. So I said, hey, I'd be glad to fly on that. And sure enough, I got assigned to it. It was great, because for a while, when I didn't get those three flights, it's kind of like, being at Disneyland and they close the line right when you get to Space Mountain and you're thinking, this is too bad. But finally, they picked the crew on 135 and I was on it, and I was excited. And we kept it as a crew of four because of that fact that there would only be, there wouldn't be a shuttle to rescue, so you'd have to come home on Russian Soyuz spacecraft. Mm-hmm. And so it worked out, and they finally decided they had the funding, which I kind of knew all along. I said, if they name this crew, they're going to fly us, because the Americans don't leave one firework left in the box. They fire them all off. So if there's an external tank and two SRBs, they're going to shoot them off, and I'm going to be on it. And so it was pretty cool. So sure enough, we flew that. Now, it was a interesting buildup to the flight, because there were a lot of people who were going to, frankly, be losing their jobs in the flight, either during the flow when they finished training us or finished preparing different parts of equipment. And so we'd be at the Kennedy Space Center sometimes, and I remember people come up to me and they'd say, hey, so I'll let you know that I've been working on this program for 25 years and this is my last day. And I'd say, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. But then they would say, no, don't be sorry. I have loved every minute of it, and they were happy to be a part of the program. So there was, it was kind of bittersweet. But people were so happy to be part of it and to see the ending of it, And so, and we would honor those folks, and we would try to thank them for their work the best we could. And at the same time, we had to prepare like it was just any other mission. So for some people, they were getting, it was kind of the ending. For us, it was the mission began at liftoff. And so we had to be ready and prepare for the mission. And then some people would ask you, did it hit you during the mission? Well, for most of the mission, it was just like any other mission, and that you had to get things done, and you were go, 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 and a lot of stress, but an incredible experience. And it was periods of, things you enjoy very much looking out the window. So like you had those highs and the lows and all the different stuff of a space flight. And the one time it really hit me was when we undocked from the space station. We're pulling away from the space station. My job was to shoot a handheld laser off the station to tell how fast we were departing. And so I would, and there's only a certain little bit of room in the window, so you kind of have to take turns what people are doing, taking pictures or using a laser. So I go up to the window and I shoot the laser off. And then I kind of float back away from the window, and over the radio, Ron Guerin from the space station says, Atlantis, departing the space station for the last time. And I have to admit, I got a little lump in my throat. I go, wow, yeah, this is it. And so times like that were a little bit, a little bit bittersweet.
And because when you're up there, again, as you mentioned, you're so mission focused and operating just at such the margins that there just isn't an opportunity to kind of let your mind drift and daydream and really soak in this otherworldly thing that you're doing. It's, you're there for a very specific reason. You've been training for months, if not years, to do it. This is the other thing I wanted to get to. There are tens of thousands of people back on Earth who have also contributed to what you're trying to do up there.
Yep.
I wanted to talk about that a little bit. And you mentioned in going back to Germany and touring a ball bearing factory. That's something I think that gets lost behind sort of the glitz and the glamour of the actual flights to and from, is just this army of engineers all over the world that help make all these things possible. It's amazing.
It really is amazing. And it's, and kind of as you get, after you've flown and kind of have a chance to reflect on it, you really see it. And, it's great to interact with everybody during the training and during the mission. And after the mission, you kind of get to go around to the different NASA centers and thank those people for their work. But it really is. And the amazing thing about it is you're kind of at the tip of the spear when you're the crew office. And you really realize that. It takes a tremendous amount of people to make it happen, for the entire organization. And it is such a unique experience to be the tip of the spear and to be the people that they are all supporting, especially the closer you are, you get to flight, the more they take care of you, and they realize, okay, they're going to protect you, go in quarantine so you don't get sick. And as it gets closer, you start having SWAT teams following you around, and when you're driving through to inspect the vehicle, the gates fly open, and you drive straight on there. Nobody's asking for your badges and stuff, and they're making sure you get whatever you need, and you fly the mission. And it's always fun. My commander said after the mission, but that all changes. You come back, deck the ground, and it's, hey buddy, where's your badge? You're back at the end of the line. The line starts here. You all get over here.
Back to work.
Back to work. But it is a pleasure to work with that many people who are so you know, so diligent about making it safe to fly. And it's great to be part of that too. You know, so now I've flown 3 times and I won't get a chance to fly again. You know, but I am still part of the program. I'm the Deputy Director of Safety at Johnson Spacer, and I love being part of it. I love helping develop these new vehicles that we're building and making sure they're safe for the next generation of astronauts and being part of that crowd that helps these people fly in space.
Maybe that's a good time to get into. I wanted to mention the Orion project, which is sort of the next big thing, which I don't know how many people really have heard about this, know about this. This program and sort of where it's come from, where it's at, and where it's headed. Maybe you could share a little bit.
Sure. So that kind of folds back into why did we retire the space shuttle? The space shuttle could have flown, you know, we could have built more tanks. We could have, you know, flown it for a long time. The problem was we wanted to go into deep space. You know, we built the space station. So the main reason for the shuttle and the last parts of the shuttle program was to build the space station. It was the big pickup truck. It hauled the heavy, heavy pieces of the space station. We'd bring them up there and piece the space station together. So now we finished the space station, and so what we really want to do is go into deep space. And so in order to do that, you can't fly the existing programs and develop a new program because it costs a lot of money to develop a new program. And so what we want to do is we want to retire the shuttle and use that money to develop these new programs. But there's two phases to that. The first thing is we still need a way to get our astronauts to the space station because we wouldn't have the shuttle to ferry people back and forth. So for the last 8 years, we relied on the Russians. And the Russians have been good partners, and they'll take our astronauts up to the space station. But there's a cost to that, you know, tens of millions of dollars we have to spend to train our astronauts and to have them fly on the Russian Soyuz spacecraft. So the first part of the program is instead of sending that money to Russia, we want to develop these new commercial vehicles that are not space shuttles, they're not big elaborate, they're space taxis. They send our people, they're capsules, they're small capsules, they're meant just for a few days in space where they dock with the space station, they stay in a quiescent mode for 6 months, and they bring the astronauts back. So we have two providers of these new space taxis or commercial crew program, and that's Boeing and SpaceX. SpaceX, you've probably heard of, they're launching satellites already, and Boeing is a big aerospace contractor. Mm-hmm. They're going to build a capsule that goes on top of the Atlas V, and the SpaceX builds a Dragon capsule that goes on top of their Dragon rocket. And so these two companies SpaceX has already flown the first test flight without a crew, and Boeing will do the same shortly, and then they'll both start flying our astronauts. So instead of contracting with the Russians for these tickets back and forth to the space station, we'll do it with American companies. And that's kind of the method of what NASA wants to do. What NASA does is we do the leading edge technology, and then we try to hand it over to the civil sector. See, and when we were first starting this space program, we couldn't just toss money and say, hey, go do this. We kind of had to chart the course with a government-led program. So now we've been in low Earth orbit for 50 years, so we can hand that over to SpaceX and Boeing and allow them to do that type of activity, as well as any other kind of shoot-offs or spin-offs that they can generate from that activity. And that allows NASA to do the true exploration, to go deeper into space, back to the moon, onto Mars someday. And the way we're going to do that is through the Orion program. The Orion is a capsule similar to an Apollo capsule, but obviously very much more advanced. And it rides on a rocket called the Space Launch System, or SLS. So we had one test flight of Orion back in, I think it was 2014. Mm-hmm. And then we're getting ready to do another test on top of this new rocket, SLS, in hopefully next year or early 2021, see how things go. And that'll be an uncrewed flight, and then we'll fly a crew on it in about 2023. And that allows us, again, to get to the moon, it's a whole other ballgame. You need a big rocket and a capsule that can handle going into the deep space environment. And so with that program, we'll be able to go to the moon, and we're looking with, it's been now named the Artemis program. And if you, Artemis is the twin sister of Apollo, and the aim is to land the first woman and the next man on the moon by 2024. That's an ambitious goal, and we're going to do the best we can. If we get the funding we need and we work hard, we can hopefully achieve that goal.
And I'm glad you brought that up. I'm curious, you know, what is the mechanism? Because when you look back at the history of NASA, so much of that history and so much of the major accomplishments, whether it's John Glenn's first orbit, whether it's the landing on the moon in 69, so much of that was a part of the space race and had sort of a military component to it, and a desire to have some sort of superiority in this specific way in space.
Right.
Does basic human curiosity get us back out of low Earth orbit? Does a profit motive get us back out? Does a military objective get us out? What is the thing that gets us back out?
There's a potential profit motive. You know, we never know what kind of resources we could use from the moon. There's always that curiosity. There's something in the human heart, as someone said, that desires to know what's wrong over the next hill and to extend humanity's reach. And when you're part of the space program, that's what it really feels like. It's a neat feeling to go up to the space station and you dock with this vehicle and there's people living up there. It's absolutely amazing. You just go through this incredible ride into orbit and then you find this little tiny outpost that starts out with a little star and you approach it and it looks like a TIE fighter with a little solar arrays on the side of it. And then all of a sudden you dock it and you open the hatch and there's your friends. And these 10 people or 13 people or however many people with you in the shuttle and the station crew are the only members of humanity that have left the Earth and are off the Earth at that time. And it's a neat feeling. And I think people recognize that and they want to see those people venture farther. And you want to go to the moon and even farther to Mars someday and to extend, get a toehold in the universe. And, there's a lot to be said by going to Mars. Mars once had an atmosphere like ours. We need to find out, was there life there? And also, what caused Mars to go dormant like it is, to lose its atmosphere? And what kind of implications does it have for Earth, where maybe there's ways we can prevent that from happening here?
Along the way, it's not just simply what do we learn when we get to Mars. It's all the technology that you have to develop just to get there.
Exactly.
And then finding other avenues to deploy that technology here
right.
on Earth.
I mean,
how many examples can you list off
exactly.
over the last 50 years of
yeah.
stuff that was first thought up of at NASA and
right.
has found its way into your home?
Exactly. Yeah, there's all these problems we need to figure out. And in the process of figuring that, you end up with new technologies that has spinoffs that other industries can use.
In doing a little bit of research, spacewalks was that kind of your thing? Is that
yes.
that was your deal?
Yeah, that kind of became my thing. So my first mission, I was a rookie spacewalker because I hadn't done a spacewalk. So I went out with Steve Smith, a senior astronaut who had done many spacewalks before. And so I kind of learned the ropes from him and Jerry Ross, another senior spacewalker on the mission. And we went up and we attached a big truss segment to the space station and bolted it down and electrically connected it and stuff. And once I finished that mission, that kind of put me on the path of doing spacewalks for my next jobs in between space flights. So I was the spacesuit rep between my first and second mission. I flew the second mission as a lead spacewalker. Now I got to take guys out for their first spacewalk. And then came back and was the lead of the spacewalking branch in the astronaut office. So I kind of took that spacewalking track.
That's sort of an even smaller fraternity yet of not just astronauts, folks in the astronaut corps, but folks who, once they get up there, are out walking around and doing stuff.
Yeah, it's a very unique experience, and it's great to be a part of. It's a little overwhelming at first, when you're... Especially, I was getting ready for my first flight, and before we fly, we spend many, many hours underwater in a pool that's 40 feet deep. It's one of the largest indoor pools in the world, and we practice our spacewalks there. And before my first mission, I spent over 200 hours underwater practicing over and over these spacewalks. And before it's hard to imagine that the next time you're doing this, you're going to do it in space. And I remember being in the pool and looking down at the bottom of the pool and thinking, next time that's going to be the Earth. And it's overwhelming. But I remember one of my friends, one of my colleagues, Pat Forrester, he flew a little bit for me. He said, don't worry, when you get outside, it's going to feel like you've been there 100 times before. And I go, yeah, sure. And so, when I first launched and got to space, everything is new in space. You've been trained on how to do all your tasks, but just living in space is hard. How do you eat? How do you brush your teeth? How do you go to the bathroom, of course? All these things are somewhat overwhelming at first. And then... just on the fourth day of the mission, you're going to go out and do a spacewalk. You go, you got to be kidding me. And so I remember going out my first spacewalk, and one of the first tasks was to put a torque multiplier on a bolt that I was going to put a drill on it. And so I put the torque multiplier on the bolt, and it wiggled just like in the pool. I thought, I know what I'm doing for the next 6 hours. I know these tasks. It was amazing how much it felt like the pool, with some big differences though. In the pool, when we're going in orbit, we're going around the Earth every 90 minutes. So we're going for the first 45, you're out in front of the Earth and it's beautiful, sunny, and you can see everything. And then 45 minutes later, you're going to the behind the Earth and it gets dark. And so those day-night cycles every 45 minutes, we don't practice those in the pool because it wouldn't be safe with all divers in the water and stuff. And so your first experience of of working when the lights go out is on orbit. Now, we have helmet lights to light up our area, but it doesn't, you know, light it up like you would a nice sunny day does.
Right. Has, you know, being able to look back at all the time you've spent in space, like 500 plus hours, right? Have you come across anything, movie, someone's writing, another astronaut's account, anything that comes anywhere close to being able to really capture and convey what it's like to be up there?
Well, I think from a movie perspective, the best one is Apollo 13. They were extremely accurate, and they pride themselves. As a matter of fact, they filmed it in what looked like Mission Control, but they didn't film it in Houston. They built a soundstage that looked, it was so incredibly like Houston that it may, even people who worked in that building, it would have, be hard-pressed, unless they looked carefully, could tell that it wasn't the real Mission Control Center. So they were very accurate about that and about with the storyline and stuff. So it was a pleasure to watch. Now, I like all the space movies, whether they're accurate or not. I mean, some of them were more fun than others. You know, Space Cowboys and Armageddon, they're really pretty goofy. But you enjoy the best parts of them. There were some, you know, some of them are a little bit, you know, a little bit far-fetched, but you still enjoy them. Like Gravity was, using fire extinguishers to fly you around and stuff. Right. That was a little much. But another aspect of that mission movie, like in Gravity, they had the inside of the space station. It looked really accurate. They did a great job on that. It just had to quibble with some of their spacewalking techniques. So, but that's okay. It's still fun to watch.
Well, that's the whole point, is a bit of suspension of disbelief for those sorts of things. Something else that I noticed when I was looking into things is, and so, that kind of surprised me is, it didn't really surprise me. I just had never thought of it before. For astronauts going up, when you're sort of packing your gear, there's all the stuff, of course, that you need, that you have to have, that you're assigned to have.
Yes.
And there's a little bit of room for your own stuff.
Right.
How important is that to pick out the, you know, this very little bit of space and weight that you have to take some little memento from home?
Yeah.
That has to be really important for astronauts to figure that out. That has to mean whatever it is probably means a lot.
Yes. Maybe
you could tell a little bit about some of the things.
Sure.
You took.
So there's about 10 items you can bring for people that you've known that you want to bring something. And there's all sorts of requirements and stuff. And there's some for organizations you've worked, you know, your school and stuff like that you've done. And then there's a few that you can take up for yourself. So there's kind of a gradation of what those things are. So most of the stuff is packed away, and you don't even get to see it. It's, you know, kind of ballast in the vehicle, and so you don't get to pull it out. And there's a few things that you can bring that you can pull out. You know, like I brought a Bible, and I brought some pictures of my family and my knee board and stuff too. There's only a handful of them. So one of the most interesting things I brought was, my brother is a horticulturist. My brother Lance. And he grows roses and writes books on them. And so he said, hey, Rex, why don't we bring a rose in space? And I thought about it, and I go, you know, and so we packed one away where I couldn't see it. And then I had one item left that I could bring, something that I could pull out and see during the mission. And so I said, well, let's put it in a little plastic container so I can see it. And we'll put it, and I'll take it out and take a picture in space with it. And then, you know, he works with the Rose Parade, and so we can maybe put it in the Rose Parade. But don't tell him first in advance, because if this thing gets smashed to smithereens, I don't want, you know, the whole world to come crashing down on me because my rose didn't survive the space travel. So we'll do it, and we'll take some pictures of it. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. So we put it in this nice little clear container, and we packed it away in one of the drawers on the shuttle where I could get to it. And so I remember... We launched orbit and stuff, and then not too long after that, I think, I wonder if the rose survived, because it was a dried rose, you know, and they're pretty delicate, those dried roses.
Right, yeah.
Because that's what we had to use. And so I go flying down to the mid-deck, open the locker, pull out the container, and the rose looks perfect. It was beautiful. And so I was able to get it down, and then got it back down, and my brother Lance got it onto a float during the Rose Parade. And so we got to work that together, which was fun, because I kind of got to combine my brother's career with my career.
Was it difficult getting used to there's always been, and I don't know if it's the same now as it was, you know, in the 60s, which maybe that's just part of the boomer generation and being so celebrated, but there is a celebrity aspect to being an astronaut. And by the time you entered the astronaut corps, was that something that they were pretty well aware of, and that they're kind of training you for that part of it too, or do you just have to learn that as you go?
Well, they do. They train you to a certain amount. They have, when we were astronaut candidates, they put us through media training. And so a man named Bill Walsh, who helps prep people for going on various news shows and the evening shows sure. and stuff, and he did a great job. And he would do interviews with us where he would ambush you and stuff like that. Okay, this is what we're going to, you know, and then he would just, you know, change the subject and do all sorts of, see, it was a really good eye opener. So before we went out and did any public appearance type stuff, we did that. And so that was helpful. But then you, from there, you kind of learn it. But when we select astronauts, we want to select them, that people have the aptitude to handle that. How is this person going to come across? You know, do they come, you know, do you sense a hint of ego? And are they awkward? And are they, you know, shy, too shy to be able to do something like that? So we try to look for some of that kind of stuff. And then you learn it along the way pretty much too. And it works out pretty good. Now, from the celebrity stuff, the interesting thing though is it's a function of whether they know you're an astronaut, because people don't generally recognize you as an astronaut. When you're wearing the blue suit, they do. And so it's much different when you're wearing the blue suit than when you're in civilian clothes, which is great, because when you want to slip into anonymity, just don't wear the blue suit. And it works out great. It's kind of the best of both worlds.
And how about for yourself, as you got involved with NASA and got into the Astronaut Corps? I'm sure you met some of these very famous people that we all know about. And were you starstruck at all when you met some of these people?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So,
do you have to keep that in check?
Yes, so you do. So the funniest experience was when I was at the Kennedy Space Center once for a launch. I was, you know, helping out. So I was helping with some tours and stuff. And so I was going to get on a public affairs bus. And the public affairs lady, before I get on the bus, goes, "Hey, I just want to let you know that Neil Armstrong is on this bus." I'm like going, "You're kidding me. What is Neil Armstrong doing on a tour bus at the Kennedy Space Center?" And she goes, "No, he's bringing his grandkids or some of his relatives, and he wants to show them around. But you can't let anybody know you know who he is, because he'll get mobbed, you know." And so I wasn't sure. I was nervous, you know. But I was excited too to meet. I'd met him just briefly before, but never, you know, had a chance to spend a little bit of time and talk with him. And so we get on the bus and we get off at the various places, and I'm walking in the vehicle assembly building, which is the big cavernous building at the Kennedy Space Center. And he comes up and talks to me, and he was just as nice as could be. And it was really a neat experience, and I really treasure it, just have a chance to to spend some time with him. You know, because some people said he was more shy and reserved, but he was just as nice as can be. And you know, I think it was Maya Angelou who said, you know, "People won't remember what you said, but they'll remember how you make them feel." And he made me feel just great. You know, he came up to me and just made me feel just really good and talked to me about stuff. So it was a lot of fun. The interesting thing, though, was, so he was incognito, and I didn't tell anybody who was there and stuff. And so there's one point in the tour where one of the other ladies on the tour was going to take a picture of me. I was wearing my blue suit, so they knew I was an astronaut. And before she took the picture, there was a guy in front of me. So she waited till he backed up. And sure enough, that was Neil Armstrong. And I couldn't tell her, "Lady, you want a picture of him, not me." But he just backed out of the picture, and she took a picture of me. So it was a neat day.
That's, and I have to, there are probably so many stories like that you have, just sort of around the office kind of things.
Yeah.
What strikes me is that a part of the job of being an astronaut, again, and talking about the different eras of the NASA programs, as a participant in the shuttle era or whatever era, there's a kind of a keeper of the flame sort of a thing that I don't know how much you realize that's going on sort of at the time, but as a program era kind of comes to a close, you realize we created some history here.
Yeah. And you know, you do sense a difference between the program. You know, so when the shuttle program was going, we had a very high operational tempo. We were flying, you know, 4 or 5 times a year, sometimes even more. Mm-hmm. And so there was always a crew getting ready to fly, a crew coming back, and you felt like a flying squadron. And so when the shuttle ended, it was harder for the new astronauts because that ops tempo wasn't there. We were still flying, but we were flying once every 6 months from, you know, or maybe up to once every 4 months over in Russia. And so when the launches are only every 3 or 4 months, they don't happen as often. And also the crews leave about, you know, maybe 6 weeks before the launch. And so they leave and you don't get to go over there to support them like you did at the Kennedy Space Center. You know, we could go down there and help with the public affairs and help with the tours and that kind of stuff. So you felt like a part of it. And when we're only launched from Russia, it's a little more difficult. And so I felt sorry for some of the newer astronauts who didn't get a chance to experience what it was like during the shuttle program. But now we're turning the corner and we're getting the new vehicles ready, and it's going to get back to that where we're launching from the United States again. It's going to be a real fun time for them.
Thank you so much for being so generous with your time. I just have a few more questions I wanted to
Sure.
go over. Another part, you mentioned your brother earlier.
Yes.
And being a gardener, contributing that dried rose for one of the missions. I know your wife also plays a part.
Yes.
And it struck me as so interesting because there's like this sort of a Gene Kranz kind of a thing where he sort of famously had the vest that that his wife made. And your wife designs the patches. Is that right?
She did for our missions. So each crew gets to design their own mission patch. And so my wife, before we had kids, she was a graphic designer. And so she's a very talented graphic designer and a graphic artist, and so she volunteered, hey, I can make some sketches for your patch for the first mission. And so she made some sketches, and I showed them to my crew, and they liked them, made some tweaks and stuff, but they decided they would go with the design that she made, and I loved it. And so then the next crew, we did the same thing, and she designed that one, and so she ended up doing it for all three, and for the final mission, she designed her patch for that one too.
That's so cool. That's just such a neat piece to be able to take along with you.
It does, and it makes it very special.
The last, I guess it's kind of a silly question, and it just popped up to me while we were talking kind of about the movie things and the ways, different ways that space exploration has been portrayed. I wonder if, is there, as you're preparing for a mission, is there any time, or maybe your discipline is such that you don't have room for this sort of in your RAM space, but the basic consideration that we are operating on the margins, there is a possibility that something could go wrong. Did you ever have a thought, maybe now with having some time to look back on the missions, who would have played me in the movie if I had been a part of a mission where something just absolutely for the record books happened? Who would have played me in the movie? Has that ever been a...
No, not really. So I don't know how, you know.
So like I said, it's kind of a silly question.
No,
but
I don't know. And it's, you know, it's a, you know, you mentioned the margins, and you know, it is thin margins, you know, and you do think about it, but you don't. The interesting thing is you usually don't think about it at the time. When I would think about it was when, especially before my first flight, when my kids were really young, they were like 4 and 5. And I just remember, you know, when I put them to bed and I'd sit in the rocking chair next to their bed, and you know, your mind starts wandering and you think, man, what am I doing? I mean, these are little boys, and what are they going to do without me if something happened? And so that was kind of tough. But then you just kind of put it out of your mind and realize, okay, I got a job to do. And then during a launch, that's obviously the most dangerous time. And I remember my first mission, when you train for it, you train the simulator, and there's always things going wrong. There's all sorts of alarms going off, and you're taught to handle a tremendous amount of failures. So that, they have an expression, on launch day, you leave half your brain back in crew quarters because, you know, you're starstruck by the fact you're going to space, and so you're not ability to process as much. So in the simulations, we practice a whole bunch of failures so that when the real day comes, we can handle just a few failures without a problem. And so I remember on STS-110, my first mission, you know, the main engine start about 6 seconds before launch, and the vehicle starts to shake, and then the SRB's light, and you think, this is it, we're really going to space. And this feeling of adrenaline rush comes over you, and you get these wide eyes, and you go, this is it, they can't change their mind, now I get to do this job. And so that's an amazing feeling. But then there was nothing going wrong. You know, you'd look at the stuff and everything's going right. And then I remember at one point in the ascent thinking for a second, you know, I could die right now. I'll put that out of my mind. I was still loving it, you know, but the thought goes through your mind just for a quick second because you had time to think, you know, where are the alarms, you know? But then you kind of put it out of your mind and just enjoy the ride and get to space. And then from there on, everything was a lot easier.
Did it after three missions in space, does it make it difficult to, I can't, there's no way to match that on Earth. I can't imagine there's any way to match that. Does it make it not necessarily more difficult to enjoy or appreciate things, but I just, there's no way to ever reach that again.
No, you can't. And there are times, you know, the way you look at it kind of changes over time too. And I just kind of learned to expect this. One of my friends flew before me, and after he flew, you'd be surprised. Your initial reaction was after the adrenaline, you know, stops for a second. You think, you know, that was great. You know, that was amazing. I'm not sure I want to do that again. I mean, it's just so overwhelming. But then after, you know, a few weeks later, that was, you know, that was kind of cool, you know. And, you know, when I got down, I didn't think, hey, you know, I don't want to fly again. But I thought, you know, yeah, I need a break. You know, I don't want to go do that right away again. But then it starts to creep up again, because when you're part of the mission, when you're training, it's a lot of pressure, because, you know, and people are saying, oh, especially before your first mission, they think you must be so excited, and you are excited, you know, but it's not like you're going on a vacation, you know, and you're going on you're doing a mission. It's a very dangerous mission, and you don't know how it's going to turn out. I think that one of the biggest fears of astronauts is messing up. You just don't want to mess up. You know, you got so much on the line. And before the mission, you don't know that could happen. And you could make a mistake that costs millions of dollars. And so there's that, you're excited about the mission, but you got this kind of game face on. And it's kind of a unique juxtaposition because you're planning for the launch and you're inviting your friends to the launch and they're planning this huge, big party down at the Kennedy Space Center down in Florida to watch you go off. And you're getting ready for this very dangerous mission you're going off to do. So it's a strange juxtaposition. You work through it and it works out. So then once you get back, all that stress level, goes down. And one of my favorite parts of the mission is when the wheels stop and you're on the runway in the Kennedy Space Center and you realize we did it. We did the job. It was successful. We got everything done and we lived to tell about it. And we're going to get to see our families in a few minutes. And it's just a feeling of euphoria. And so that feeling is so great. And all that pressure and kind of anxiety, washes away. And then, after months or maybe a year or two, then especially you start thinking back and how great it was to be part of something that important and to be a part of such a team like that. And you start missing that importance. So, you do miss that. But now in my point in my career, I flew 3 times. And if the shuttle was still flying, I might, consider flying again. But, 3 flights was enough, I would love to have a chance to fly again if I did, but I can live with the fact that I'm not. And coming here to Alaska reinforces that. Coming here, some of the most incredible things you could do are right here on Earth when you're face to face with nature and you get to see it close hand. You get to talk to people and spend time with people, and that can be very, very rewarding. And so when you combine work you like with, even though I'm not flying in space, I'm still part of the program, and travel and doing the things you really love to do, it can be a very, very fulfilling.
Before we go, just the last question I'll have for you. When we're talking about the outreach and the education portion of what you do now, I'm curious, and especially here in Alaska, I don't know how well aware you are of it. We're having a huge debate right now over how much and to what degree we need to be funding higher education with the University of Alaska, which is a great engineering college, among many other things. I'm curious, as now kind of a science educator, do you see it as kind of an uphill battle with, when you see some of these things happening around the country, is it kind of an uphill battle to spread that message of science and the importance of studying these things and sometimes just pursuing curiosity for curiosity's sake? Because, there's no greater example of that than the space program, just simply wanting to go to space for anything. Right. Do you ever feel like it's an uphill battle, or when you're with those kids, that really, you see a lot of hope there?
I think the uphill battle may be the funding. But inspiring the next generation is not an uphill battle. You just show them it. The space program sells itself. You show them your pictures, you tell them the stories, and you see the fire in their eyes and then just the light that they get excited about it. And the only reason for apathy is not knowing about it. And so if we get out there and talk to the kids about it, they understand how exciting it is and they want to be a part of it. It's contagious. And so I don't think there's any problem selling it. It's just getting out there and doing it and telling the story. It should sell itself. True endeavors that are worth doing, they do sell themselves. And I think the space program is one of those.
Very good. Rex Walheim, thank you so much for your time. Really a pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure.